The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Bridget Laughlin, good morning.
Good morning.
And Bridget, you're an Emeritus Professor at the Robert Schuman Centre for Advanced Studies in the European University Institute in Florence, and you're an expert on all things European and Brexit and all that. And people will know that normally when you're invited onto shows like ours, it's to hear your views on Europe, or Ukraine, Brexit, and we will come to all of that. But look, we also invited you in today because you had a totally life-changing event in January, and I'm terribly sorry for your loss. Will you tell us what happened?
I will indeed. So the 5th of January, it was a Wednesday, and it was a very ordinary day. My husband Michael and I set off for Sea Point. He was a member of the Sea Pointers, a group that swam. It was a WhatsApp group, and the WhatsApp would say what time you had to be down for the swim. And it was a daily, almost daily occurrence. It was a very ordinary day. We went down, Michael changed. Dermot, my son, was coming afterwards to go for a swim with me, and my sister happened to say she'd come out. So we were there. But the person who did the long swim, the serious swimmer, was Michael. And I've obviously been watching him always in the water. And that morning, I noticed that he and another swimmer went slightly further than the others. And then he turned and was coming back. And suddenly his head popped up, and I thought, he's not swimming on, so what's happening? And I just shouted, and I don't know why, Michael's in trouble, at the swimmers, the serious swimmers. And I started running, and the tide was a very full tide, so it was right up over the walkway in Sea Point. And I ran through the water over to where I saw Michael, and he then started swimming in. Most unusually, he wasn't swimming back to the slip. He started swimming in
into shore, straight into shore.
Yeah. So by this stage, I was shouting, "Michael's in terrible trouble. Something is very wrong." And a runner was passing me, and he said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "My husband, he's definitely in trouble." He took off his shoes. Turns out he was a lifesaver. And he went in, and other swimmers went in, and my son went in. And then Michael swam for about 100 metres towards shore. But then his head went under, and all that was at the top was was the orange buoy. But they got to him really quickly, Dermot and this other great lifesaver. And so Michael was out of the water in jig time. And by that stage, everyone had taken their bear hugs and dry robes and towels. They were all on the ground ready. And there were two doctors who happened to be there. A nurse happened to be there. So they administered CPR immediately. And I was utterly convinced that Michael would be revived. I had no sense that I could possibly lose him. And then there were three, it so happens, three defibrillators. The RNLI came round with one. There was one in Sea Point, and then the ambulance. So they asked me not to look when they did the defibrillator, because apparently it's quite aggressive. And so I turned away, and they worked on Michael very hard. Obviously the ambulance came, and it was a question of getting him to hospital quickly. Still at this stage, I thought Michael's going to pop up. My brain wouldn't let me think that it could possibly be that before my eyes that this had happened. And then they brought Michael to the ambulance, wouldn't let me in the ambulance because of COVID, the new rules. And then the doctor got out and came over to me and said, "We're going to bring your husband to Vincent's. This is what we will do, but I need you to know it's not looking good." And that was my first understanding that actually Michael might be dying. And that was, I actually experienced it as almost a knife. I thought I'd keel over, but the ambulance left, and luckily my sister was there. And so my sister, Dermot, and I went to Vincent's, and my sister rang my brother-in-law to say, get Roisin, she was in Dunleary, to bring her to Vincent's immediately, because my other daughter, Kate, had gone to London the day before. And when we got to Vincent's, they had got a pulse back, but it was artificial. It was generated by the adrenaline. And so over the next hour, we just held Michael and we lost him. And even though it was really to lose someone in front of your eyes, it's seared. The sequence is, it's like a horror film in my head. I'm very glad I was there. And I'm very glad Diarmaid was there, even though it was the hardest thing we've ever experienced. And since then, it's been the hardest time of our lives and we're devastated. But Michael didn't, he wasn't on his own. And I got him out of the water as quickly as possible. And if he could have been saved, he would have been. It wasn't because there was no defibrillators or no help, no CPR. He had every chance. And that's comforting. And it's also comforting to know that he wasn't on his own, that his son carried him out. That really helps. But of course, for us, this was...
When his son was carrying him out, was he conscious at that stage?
So Diarmaid tells me that as they were bringing Dad in, he said he felt his chest heave. And maybe that meant Michael died in the water. But we don't have the autopsy yet. And that's another, it's actually, you wait 6 months for the autopsy and it's a kind of a dread in your head. When will this come? But Michael didn't drown. He obviously had a catastrophic heart episode. And he was wearing a Garmin watch. So I know, I could track the swim on the watch. But you know in your head that life can be fragile, but you actually... I now know,
yeah,
in a way that I couldn't possibly have known. It's very visceral. It's very... It's a real trauma to see someone die before your eyes. No premonition. It literally happened in 5 minutes. And he... going down that morning, we were joking because he was making a big concession to me. He wouldn't swim on Friday, on the Thursday, it was my birthday, and we had tickets for the Jack Yates exhibition in the National Gallery. And he kind of said, you know, that'll clash with the swim. And I said, well, now it's my birthday. And so it was that normal walking down. But also, it was by chance my sister was there and by chance Diarmaid was there, because he works in London and he simply at a whim said, I'll stay on another week after Christmas. Sure, COVID, I can work anywhere. So it really helped that we were all there.
Yeah, it's funny, the little things you take comfort in now, isn't it? And Bridget, you've clearly gone over and over and still going over it in your head.
Yeah. And I also wonder why it was that I knew. I mean, my brain didn't compute. I just simply said, Michael's in trouble.
Yeah.
So, and it obviously I've been watching him in the water all my life, because we're swimmers, and I never swim with him because I don't swim those lengths. I'm a sort of, in the winter, five strokes out,
bather,
five strokes back. I'm not a... and then also, I suspect if you the kind of depth of connection with someone, that somehow there was some telepathy.
Yeah.
Because when he came up, he did look to, even though he was very far away, to where he knew we were.
Yeah.
So...
And you're together since you were 18.
Together since we were 18, yeah, and married since we were 24. We were babies. Yeah.
And all your adult life really has been that partnership. The grief on its own is enough, But this is overlaid so with huge shock as well, is it?
It is, because there is the loss, but there's also the trauma of how it happened and the fact that there was no warning and literally your life changed from one day to the next.
Yeah.
And for all of us, we've three children, Diarmaid, Kate and Róisín, and Kate had left the day before at 5 o'clock from Dublin Airport. She was starting a new job at the LSE in London. And we'd all brought her and the baby to the airport. And she was in less than 24 hours, she got the call from Vincent's. And the rest of us, Diarmaid, Róisín and I were there. But Kate was in London and she had suddenly had to come home that evening. And for her to get that call and for her to have to get to Gatwick and get on a plane and come home, I mean, it's just unimaginable.
Yeah, that's the loneliest journey. And was it Kate who had texted Michael?
Yes, yeah. She had literally, because he had sent her a text. We'd found little seeds in the day before in Ada's coat. And I had said to Michael, you know, I don't like the fact that there was these little seeds, you know, a baby might swallow them. And before going to bed that
night. Because you could control everything that happened at that stage.
Exactly. And he sent her a text saying, Mum found this and you better clear out her pockets. And she'd literally replied to him at 12:30 to say she checked the pockets. And that was exactly when Michael died.
How are you coping now?
Ah, it's been the most difficult time of my life and our lives, and we're devastated, and trauma is trauma. But we're so I the one thing that brings me unadulterated joy is my grandchild Ada. If she phones me, or if she we're having her birthday here next Sunday, and it's the sense of just life is going on, and she's this beautiful, she's two, she's a COVID baby, she'll be two next week, and she's just great fun, and she'd talk for Ireland, and she gives me, every time I talk to her or I'm with her, I'm genuinely joyful. And then of course we're a very close-knit family, Kate, Diarmaid, Róisín and I, and we're all in pain, but we're all coping at a level. And then I have a very good immediate family, friends. I walk a lot at the moment. I find walking to be, it tires me. And somehow or other, if I'm moving, it helps.
On your own?
On my own or with people. I do walks with people as well. Both. And I'd say I have worn the leather from the East Pier to the West Pier to the Middle Pier to out as far as the Sandy Cove, the 40 foot and back. And that helps.
And Bridget, is it to tire you out so that you might sleep?
So for me, by far the worst are the nights. And I was a great sleeper. I was one of these sleep of the, you know, I was hit the pillow and I never had a problem sleeping. And now I do. And I find the nights very long and I'm not sleeping anything like the kinds of hours I used to sleep. But the other thing that I am finding very helpful is I knew about 3 weeks ago or four weeks ago that this was too big for me. And so I've got a counsellor who's, I know I need professional help. That this is something that you can't work through in your head and you need help. And of course, it also matters that you get the right counsellor. Not all counsellors suit everyone. And also some counsellors are much more skilled than others. And I'm just very fortunate that I have a very good counsellor who has laid out a kind of a map of the healing and how to deal with the trauma and just how to take it in stages and not to expect too much and just to keep going.
Yeah. I can imagine a plan is a helpful thing for someone else to come in and say, right, here's what's happening.
And it's not a kind of a plan that says by this date. Yeah. It's more a kind of a mapping of the how this will play out. And I've no expectation as to when what's happening or anything. And then the other thing that, and that this surprised me, is that I find if I can go back, sit at my desk and write for maybe 3 hours a day or work on something, it stills the brain and gets rid of the racing thoughts and gets rid of the torment. Mm. And I have found that very helpful. I have found being able to take my head completely to a different space and just read. And at the beginning, I couldn't concentrate, but if I persisted, and I was able to, like last week, I had to deliver the Asser lecture in The Hague. It was something I had committed to doing in early November and was cancelled due to COVID. And I thought, I'll never be able to do it. But then I said, I'll do it. Mm. And it was on effectively, you know, can collective power Europe emerge from Putin's war? So it was very current.
Yeah.
And I had to read stuff that kept me up to date on a lot of things. And doing that was very helpful.
Because you had kind of retired, Michael was retired, and he had plans for that next phase of life then, didn't you?
We did. I mean, academics really don't. So academics retire in the sense of they don't get paid. But I don't think they ever retire from the things, yeah, that they're interested in. But I was certainly going to do much less, and we were delighted to be back in Dublin. We were getting, our home house had been rented because we were in Italy, and I was we were looking forward to getting it back in February, and we now have it. But it's under very different circumstances, yeah, and we were thinking of going to New Zealand to see my sister. And then Italy is one of those very seductive countries where it kind of gets in on you. And so we had a flat in Liguria that we had bought, that we would have done up during, we had planned to do up to be ready for when we were retired. But then, of course, COVID hit. And so there was no doing anything. But last November, we were there and we were planning, you know, knocking down those walls and putting a decent bathroom in and whatever. And I'll sell it now. I really? Can't. Oh, yeah. Can't ever go there. No. I don't want.
You went back down swimming.
I went back down swimming. And that was my son. He said, "Mum, put on your togs." Bossy. And I thought, I'll put on the togs, but I mightn't go in. And when I went down, kind of routine took over, took off the clothes and went in. And my mother swam until she was very close to 80. So we're a swimming family. And I'm very glad I managed to get in, because I didn't think I was going to.
Mm.
I didn't genuinely think that I could go in, and particularly to Sea Point. I didn't think I could swim in that water. And now I'm very glad I did, because swimming gives you a great boost.
Yeah.
It, no matter how you feel going in for a swim, if you're stressed or distressed or whatever, you come out of the water feeling renewed.
Yeah.
And so after this now, I'll have my swim.
Oh, good. And I know one thing you want to do before we leave this is you did want to say a kind of a thank you to all those people who rallied around down there. And there is there's a great old community down there, isn't there?
I'm very humbled and completely overwhelmed by people's kindness and support. And that day, I mean, people were taking off the towels and everything. And also, since then, the kindness that we were showed, but you know, the RNLI, the doctors, all those that cared, that really tried to help Michael, and all those who've been kind to us since, I'm glad that we were home, because I'd have hated this to happen in Italy.
Yeah.
It would have seemed very alien, whereas this was home. And I'm also very glad that we weren't allowed to have a wake because it was still COVID, but we could have a funeral. And again, experiencing that, I think awful scars have been left by COVID for families that couldn't properly celebrate and say goodbye in a proper way to their loved ones. So I'm very glad. Michael did not die because there wasn't help.
Yeah. Listen, so as you alluded to there, you kind of re-engaged with work at a very interesting time, considering your areas of interest and everything. I suppose the war in Ukraine being the obvious thing, which I think has had, you know, we'd all agree, all kinds of ramifications for Europe and everything. Where do you see it going?
So I think it's very delicately poised just now. Putin has failed. His gamble has failed. He really thought 3 days into Kyiv, decapitate Zelensky, puppet regime, happy days, we'll take the country. That's failed. He's now moved to lesser war goals, to just try to take the Donbass, link that to Crimea and cause as much havoc as possible. And if he could exclude Ukraine from seaports, he would like to do that as well. But the Ukrainian army, clearly since Crimea in 2014, is much better than it was. It's receiving a lot of intelligence from the West. It's receiving a lot of hardware and it's fighting smart. And the Russians are clearly in military trouble, which is fine. But they have two things. They can bomb from the air. And as we know, Mariupol, they just have destroyed a city. And so the danger is, as the war goes further against him, which appears to be the case, what will happen? Will he escalate to biological, chemical, and the big N, nuclear? And Russia is not a regime anymore. It's a one-man band. And those are very dangerous. And Putin is very dangerous when cornered. So it's very delicately poised.
You're worried, are you?
I am worried because I think, I mean, this was never just about Ukraine. It was about destabilizing the Baltics. And so for the Europe's security architecture is in more trouble now, I would say, in the most trouble it's been since the Second World War. Now, one has to hope that there still is a rational element left in Russia and that they won't escalate beyond. For the Ukrainians, they have no choice but to fight because the alternative is the Russians will come in and obliterate them. And even we see the performance of the Russian army and troops, and the number of war crimes are just They're not observing any of the rules of war. It's terrible. So what would be the best outcome would be is if there could be a negotiated settlement.
We seem very far from that right now, don't we?
I think we're very far because they talk of the off ramp for Putin, but you can't have an off ramp unless Putin wants an off-ramp. So for Ukraine, the ideal would be, Ukraine says, we don't need to join NATO. And then other European states give security guarantees to Ukraine because no country should be exposed to this level of tyranny from a neighbour. And then in return for that, I think the Crimea is gone. I think the Russians have Crimea and it's never coming back. Okay. And then the question is, what do you do about the Donbass? And what would be an outcome that would help Putin say we've won, but not completely destroy Ukraine, and that the Russians would come back again. So there is a deal to be done, but I see no prospect of it being done, yet. And one just has to hope that it doesn't escalate in ways that get out of control.
Okay, but it sounds like you think this is a long haul one way or the other. Speaking of the long haul, Brexit is another huge area of interest for you. And I think you were writing a book on Brexit at the moment.
Yes.
Or another
yes.
book on Brexit. So what's your kind of overview now on where we are at with the protocol wars and everything else?
So it is very serious. British-Irish relations have not been this bad since, I would say, the end of the 1970s, pre-Thatcher. That's how serious this is. There was a phone call between Johnson and Micheál Martin this week. It did not go well. And I think the British are intent on unilateral action. And they may go beyond. So there's one scenario where they put a law through but never implement it. But I think they're more serious now. And I think if they unilaterally break the protocol or tear it up in whatever form, then that is as hostile an act that a British government has perpetrated on this island, I would say, since the foundation of the state.
And
What
happens then?
So then this is an international treaty that the British signed, passed through the British Parliament and on the EU side. The EU will have to respond. Now, the British might think, will we divide and conquer? Will we peel Ireland off? We're doing well in Ukraine. The Central Europeans like what we're doing. I think the EU will be it'll be apoplectic in response, in the sense that this is an international treaty and they don't see why the British can do this. So I think the EU will respond in a calibrated way, depending on what the British do. But it could go right up to the suspension of the TCA, the trade agreement, right up to that. That's on the table.
And then all of this is not going to be good for us in the Republic either, is it?
No, but none of this is good for us. But then there's also after, we must remember that 70% of those elected last week were pro the protocol. And so you now have a British government in London not being neutral between the parties and supporting the DUP and the TUV. And that's very bad news for Northern Ireland. So we're at a very delicate time. And again, one has to ask, what can the Americans do? Will they make life difficult for the British? But it's all about the Conservative Party. Johnson, Liz Truss, a bit of politics that would help them.
Yeah, okay. Listen, Bridget, going back to the early part of our conversation, I think a lot of people found that really helpful. People who have had similar situations themselves or who are in grief and everything. I'll just read you one text. Bridget is so elegantly verbalising exactly what I felt on the death of my husband. The trauma and shock are unimaginable, but our three children were there with him when he died. It happened just before COVID, so we had the great comfort of the Irish way of death. The funeral was huge. Our first grandchild arrived the day before my husband's second anniversary. Bridget is so correct about the value of a good counsellor. Grief is tough and we are changed forever, but we have to move forward. Bridget Laffin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.